Day, our movie group went to see Hotel Rwanda. We had a discussion afterwards. After the movie, I was blown away. I was angry, upset, embarrassed. And when I got to our meeting place where we were going to have the discussion, frankly, I didn't feel like talking about it very much because it was such an overwhelming emotional experience. I sat in the car for 5 minutes just trying to center myself because I didn't want to go in some abstract intellectual place. I wanted to feel what it is that I felt and to try to understand why it got to me and what I can do with the pain and the energy and the despair and the inspiration that I felt from the movie as the vehicle that brought this reality to my heart. I was, as the Hotel Rwanda is about the genocide that took place in Rwanda. And what it drives home is, for me, a profound sense of embarrassment that the world could sit by and watch tribe slaughter tribe. Watch the killing fields again as the lifeblood flowed out of people and soaked the soil of Rwanda. It's a profound sense of shame that the United Nations stood by and did nothing other than to say, please don't kill each other so much. That the United States stood by and could not even utter the word genocide, because to have used the word genocide would have necessitated legally that we actually do something about the people who were being killed, and of course the people who were doing the killing. 60 years after the end of the Holocaust in Europe, we cannot, as modern human beings, repeat the words never again with anything other than a profound sense of irony, because never again has become again and again. From Sukarno in Indonesia to Pol Pot in Cambodia, from the former Yugoslavia to Rwanda, there have been human slaughters that reached the threshold of being called genocide. That is, the attempt to wipe out a people because of their tribe, their ethnicity, their religion, their politics, some difference, some distinction that we human beings seem to find important at some point in history. And of course, part of the tragedy is those important in the moment distinctions fade and become of no meaning a generation later or two generations later. I'm embarrassed by the behavior of everyone and by just being a human being, because that capacity to create an other, to be in the blood fury of righteousness, the dehumanizing of the cockroaches, the vermins, the dogs, the pigs, whom we label our adversaries to be when we would make of them enemies, when we would make of them victims, is virtually universal, and no country, no religion, no ethnicity is immune from the blood madness. We say each time that these things happen, we're going to learn. We're going to learn and we're going to be different next time. But each next time looks like the previous time. And it's not that this stuff is easy. I know that. There are feuds that are blood feuds, that are traditional feuds, that are about issues that we in the United States cannot hope to understand. There are ethnic hatreds, there are universal ideas of Hatfields and McCoys that we don't get. We don't understand why Sunni and Shia would be angry at each other, or why two brands of Shia, the Alawites and the Ishmaelites, might want to kill each other over minuscule differences that are of no meaning to us. But again, we can't understand why during the Arian heresy, that is of Bishop Arius, that Christians killed each other over whether Jesus was the same stuff or just like the stuff of God. And these words, these ways we have of pushing each other away and apart, are difficult to understand rationally. And it's difficult to know when to intervene and when not to intervene. I understand that. It's very hard, because the victims and the victimizers, the aggressors and the slaughtered, can change roles without signaling. They can be winning and not want any help at all because they're killing the other guys very nicely. And the tide of battle turns, and the aggressor then becomes the victim. And I understand that we don't want to go into these places and be the policeman of the world, the arbiter of the world. I understand that had we gone into Rwanda, I might have been marching and picketing against our intervention. That I wouldn't want my child going over there to die and to kill. I'm aware of all of the conflicts, maybe even hypocrisies, in my... Aristotle called the reaction that you have to tragedy pity and awe, that you want to approach and you are repelled at the same time. That's exactly what I feel and what I see when I see these internecine slaughters of human beings and the madness. I don't have a good answer. I don't have an easy answer. But standing by and watching doesn't seem to me to be a good answer either. One of the things that keeps us from intervening, from going in, is that we don't understand every situation, that everybody, every country has some different dog in the fight. We also are very wary of judging sovereign nations. And when is it a slaughter and when is it a civil war? When are they fighting dissidents and insurgents and revolutionaries? And what do all of these words mean to us? We know that we don't want other nations coming in and judging American domestic policy. Whenever we criticize China, and in my view we criticize it fairly accurately and a little bit softly, the Chinese respond to by talking about American civil rights violations of blacks and Hispanics. Whenever we criticize Russian elections, the Russians have one good English word that they always say, Florida. But there is a difference between politics and policies that are unfair, that are prejudicial, maybe even cruel, and genocide. Policies that are designed to eliminate human beings by race, creed, tribe, or politics. There may be a fuzzy line, but there is a line. And the world cannot stand by and see slaughter after slaughter and simply act like the old British bobbies who were unarmed in a more peaceful time and would go and say, "Stop thief!" or I'll cry, "Stop again!" That's what the United Nations does. It issues all of these resolutions. We issue resolutions. We condemn and say, "Stop," or I'll say, "Stop again." This seems very weak when human beings are dying. But maybe it's politics and it's just too complicated and we can't do anything about it. Well, what about the other mass killings and die-offs? What about the 6, the 10s, the 20s of millions who are dying each year from HIV/AIDS in Africa, in Southeast Asia, increasingly on the Indian subcontinent, and moving into pandemic numbers in China and even the Soviet Union. Well, gee, genocide is just too political, and HIV/AIDS is transmitted mostly by sex, and that's much too delicate and difficult to talk about, even if it is mostly heterosexual sex that's transmitting it, and so the world is relatively quiet. Well, okay, I got another one. The number one preventable cause of death in the world is dehydration from dysentery, and it kills more children than anything else in the world. I don't use the term Holocaust lightly, coming from Holocaust surviving family, but it is more than 6 million children a year die of dysentery. The fix is not that intellectually complicated. It's clean the water and it's hydrate the children. But if genocide is too political and AIDS is too sexy, dysentery just isn't sexy at all and makes very bad posters. So we need a tragedy that's cute. We need a tragedy that's apolitical and just has the right attraction to galvanize humanity. This is madness. This is madness because it's about human beings. One of the things that really got me in this movie was that the hero, Paul, is not a saint. He does not start out in the beginning with sounding like St. Francis of Assisi. He starts out saying, I want to save my family in the midst of this madness, and I want to preserve some of my dignity. I don't want to lose this appearance of class and of civilization. And he believed that a well-pressed shirt, a European suit, was class and civilization, and soon became disabused of that view, as Western civilization wasn't civilized and stayed out. The shirt, the tie, the suit, the watches, the rings, the scotch, the cigars, this is the veneer of civilization, not civilization itself. Throughout the course of his story, which is essentially a true story, he expanded his sense of what his responsibility was beyond just his immediate family to a larger sense of family, a family beyond his immediate relatives, to people of different tribes, different ethnicities, different backgrounds. This, I think, is what it means to grow as a human being. Yes, we start at home. We start at home trying to be good and decent and kind to the people closest to us. And yes, we see differences and distinctions in political parties and religions and all of these ways that we identify the other. But as we grow, hopefully we leave kindergarten, about which I'm not terribly sentimental, and we have a greater sense of being connected to more and more people who look and act different from ourselves and our immediate families. We grow in a sense of openness and compassion, the embrace of our arms and our hearts and our sense of responsibility expands as we mature, and this is the voyage we see Paul on in Hotel Rwanda. He can't save everyone. It's always, and for everyone, a Sophie's choice. Some live and some die. Some we reach out a hand to, and we can't grasp every hand out there that needs us, but we have a responsibility to grasp those hands that we can. And it's an agonizing decision of when to reach out and when to pull back, of when our hearts are out there and exposed, and when we are overexposed and are being pulled under ourselves. And those places will be different for different people and at different times in our lives. But nonetheless, we have responsibilities beyond just people who look like us. One of the most beautiful and poignant scenes to me in the movie is that Paul and his wife are on the roof of the Hotel Rwanda, and they fully expect to die. And they're cuddling together, and they're huddling together, and they are kissing and smiling and saying, "We had a good life." They are not paralyzed by the terror of impending death. They are not erasing all of the good memories because they expect to die momentarily. They are saying, "It has been worthwhile being alive on this planet and having each other and holding each other and loving each other, even if, or maybe especially because, it is finite." And that's, for me, where the inspiration comes, because we're all guests in the Hotel Rwanda, on that roof of that hotel. We are all sitting in the light for a few moments, huddling, hopefully cuddling once in a while, and feeling the wonder and the joy that life has to offer, and we are all facing a sunset. A sunset that will cast darkness on our lives and our hearts, and of loss of others, and eventually of loss of self. That is the human condition. We can't ultimately save ourselves. We can't ultimately save everyone, but while it is light, while the sun shines, we can do what we can do with open eyes and hearts and minds and arms. It doesn't solve all of the problems, not ours and not the world's, but we have the responsibility to do what we can do and to know that that can make all of the difference for a time to those who are caught in our embrace. And even beyond those in the immediate embrace, those whom we touch, those whom we help, we have conveyed an important message, not with our words, but with our hands and with our lives and with our time. Because time is the only gift that we have to give each other. Our time and our passion and our caring, wherein we hold the entire world within our being, in each beat of our heart. Life is delicate. Life is finite. But there are no better words than we have had, both in the opening readings and in the hymns of St. Francis. The challenge to bring peace where there is war, to bring forgiveness where there has been insult, to bring hope where there is despair, and to be instruments of peace, however we see and understand the source of peace within creation.